Welcome to the Danilo Husar-Struk Annual Memorial Lecture. Today is the 25th anniversary lecture. It's hard to believe that 25 years have gone by. I would have liked to say that today is the 25th lecture, but COVID got in the way and we lost a year. But we have had 24 lectures, and I am very happy that we continued this year. Of course, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming. And in particular, I want to thank Danilo's family for coming and his friends. You honor me by your presence, and I hope you intend to honor Danilo by your presence. I also want to thank the folks at CIUS in Alberta, the Danilo Husar-Struk program in Ukrainian literature is today located in Toronto, but it is a part of the University of Alberta, of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, which is itself part of the University of Alberta. And so I am very grateful to them for their help and support. I had hoped to sit through the first minute of this lecture and let myself be introduced by the director of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies, Natalia Hanenko-Friesen, but Dr. Friesen was, in the last minute, torn away with other things. Many of you may know that there is a lot going on in Alberta, and the director of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies has many things on her plate. I also want to thank, in particular, Jennifer Fedun, one of the folks at CIUS, in particular for the poster that she created, that's a part of the poster, and also for letting me talk her into putting an image of Taras Shevchenko on the poster, because Taras and Maxim is, of course, Professor Kuznarski and myself. And what I really want to talk about is the state of Ukrainian studies at the University of Toronto, where we are the two Ukrainianists. The state of affairs is, in one sense, very, very good. We are very, very proud at the Slavic Department at the University of Toronto because two of our students have received offers for positions, and not just any positions. These two students, Alex Auerbuch and Olya Khumeta, are graduates of our program. I'll say just on the slide, both of them wrote their exams in the Russian program, but nevertheless, they are Ukrainianists. And they are both starting jobs July 1, presumably, or September, as the case may be, at universities in the United States. Olya Khumeta at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, Alex at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, in important universities, and both of their positions are Ukrainian positions. That is, they're not hired for something else. Both of them are in the room today. If you'd stand up, please, and take a bow. I didn't put them in those positions. And I do want to moderate our joy with some other situational remarks. We have another victory, smaller technical victory at the University of Toronto, and that is that the center that is, in some sense, created to combine all kinds of Ukrainian things at the University of Toronto, the Petro Yacek program, is part of a larger unit that for the longest time carried the name of Russia in its title. And why this happened, that is, there's actually a terrible story, terrible from our end, why that happened. It had to do with animosity towards the Ukrainians at the university. But I am very happy to say that recent decisions at the University of Toronto mean that that center will be the center for European and Eurasian studies. Those of us who rather vehemently objected and said, get the R out of series, are finally justified. So that's another victory. But now I want to talk about some of the things that aren't so victorious. The program in Ukrainian literature, language and literature, at the University of Toronto is now the only one in Canada. There is no program in Edmonton. You cannot get a degree at the University of Alberta. You cannot get a degree at the University of Winnipeg. These things used to be possible. We in Canada usually pride ourselves, and for many years the Americans were eager to tell us how lucky we were to have Ukrainian studies so well founded in Canada. Well, we are still doing well, but the situation is not all positive. And as the old man in the program right now, I am the old man at the Slavic department today, next in line for retirement, so to speak, I've been told in no uncertain terms that my position does not get renewed. In fact, the last three positions that the Slavic department lost to retirements have not been renewed. And so it's very important that our community, particularly the Ukrainian community in Toronto, be aware of the fact that not everything is moving smoothly ahead. There are other issues as well. That is, the chair of Ukrainian studies at the University of Toronto is endowed and is not at risk. But notice that the name of the position is the chair of Ukrainian studies. That needs to be a history chair. It is a history chair today. That's who holds the chair, Professor Paul Robert Makuchi. But We as a community need to make sure that the university doesn't allow itself to do something else, to put someone else in that position other than a historian. So those are the facts as they are. But I am nevertheless hopeful, and I do see a future for Ukrainian studies and for Ukrainian literature here in Canada. And I hope we find the wisdom and the right people to move forward. And in that regard, I want to make another announcement, this one regarding myself. That is, I've been running the Struk program at CIUS for 25 years now, since it was created. It's time to step away. That is, I've done this long enough, and it's time to find someone with new ideas and new energy and fresh blood. And so I will be stepping away from my role as the director. It's a very minor role. I organize a couple lectures a year, and that's it. But let's find someone else to do this, and the folks at the University of Alberta at CIUS need to look around. And Your input is not irrelevant. So as you see, the talk really is about Taras and me. and Ukrainian studies. Except that I arrived at this topic in part when I decided to step away from the Struk program because I felt guilty about it. That is, you don't want to give up on something because everybody's going to say that you punked out. And that guilt is the topic of today's talk. But not my guilt, because the Maxim in the title Taras and Maxim is not Tarnowski. We don't really know what his surname is, but he's Maxim Ulasevich. And he is the hero of Taras Shevchenko's poem Moskaleva Krenecha. Moskaleva Krenecha is a complicated work, and I will be telling you a great deal about its creation. I want to add one more introductory caveat, and that is, I'm not used to talking about Shevchenko in English. I teach Shevchenko at the university, and I had the enormous pleasure of teaching the Shevchenko course this year with so-so success. That is, one of the students was absolutely brilliant and a joy to work with. Another one of the students couldn't read Ukrainian, and I don't know what she was doing in this course, but when you have very few students, you don't chase them out, right? But Shevchenko always has to be read in Ukrainian. And I don't say this to criticize the translators. I'm a translator myself. Shevchenko is just extremely difficult to translate. And he's not only difficult to translate, that is, understanding Shevchenko depends so completely on the details of the language. And what makes Shevchenko a great poet, there are many reasons he's a great poet. Many of us think he's a great poet because he's a big Ukrainian patriot. He's that too, but mostly he's a master of language. He uses language in a way that hardly anyone else who ever wrote Ukrainian poetry could. Right? There are a few others, but very few. And so I will be speaking in English and showing you translations of Shevchenko's poetry in English on the screen, but I'm going to read the poems in Ukrainian because that's the only way to do this. Right? It reminds me the late Mrs. Huzar, who used to frequent these lectures years ago, always came up to me before and after the lecture and said the same thing. But it's in English! Do it in Ukrainian! Well, we made a decision 25 years ago that this program has as its goal to spread knowledge of Ukrainian literature in an English-speaking world. And so I've made a commitment to this. And if I stuck by my guns, I wouldn't ever talk about Shevchenko in English, but I wanted to talk about Shevchenko, and so here we are. Let me give you a brief outline of what I'm going to do today. And first, I have to talk about the word Moskal. Moskaleva Krenecha, the translated title is The Soldier's Well. Moskai is a complicated word. Then I need to talk about the concept of two voices, of two personalities. This is extremely important in reading Shevchenko. I'm going to say a few words about that. And then I'm going to turn to the poems themselves, and I'm going to talk about a couple poems in particular. Let me start with three scholars who talk about duality in Shevchenko. You probably know all their names, but let me run through them anyway. The scholars are George Grabovich, whose book The Poet is Mythmaker you see in the middle. Bohdan Rupchak, who has a very significant essay on this very question, entitled Shevchenko's Profiles and Masks, the Ironic Roles of the Self in the Poetry of the Kobzar. And that essay appeared in and was in fact written for this collection of essays, Shevchenko and the Critics. And the third one, Leonid Plyushch, a book in Ukrainian, Exod Tarasa Shevchenka, which is quite literally about Moskaleva Krenetsa, about the poems. Let me start by saying that the duality in question is in the poetry. We're not talking about the duality, the natural duality of every poet, that is, there's the poetry and the poet. That's an easy confusion to make, and one that is inherent in the duality I'm going to be talking about, because the way Shevchenko uses this duality is he throws himself into his poetry. But at some point, the person, Taras Shevchenko, is separate, and the poetry is what we're talking about. Let me say a few words about these scholars. The way George Grabovich talks about duality, he is interested, I was a graduate student of his back in that day when he was writing this book, and he was very interested in mythology, Claude Lévi-Strauss, Miso Eliade. His wife was very interested in structural anthropology. They were reading these things together. And so what he's really interested in is in myth. But in order to crack open the myth in Shevchenko, as he sees it, he talks about the adjusted self and the unadjusted self. And he talks about these two modes or personalities. You know, they're entirely different intellectual and emotional modes of expression. I'm quoting, in fact, one can speak here not so much of different stances or styles, but of different personalities. This duality, of course, should not be confined to the psychological level or reduced to an ego split or dissociation, because Grabovich wants to see in this duality something, a truth about Ukraine in principle, that is, a mythological truth about Ukraine. Rupchak's approach is a little bit different. All these approaches, they all know each other and they cite each other in their work. The Rupchak begins with romantic irony. That is, he starts with the poet's dissemination of his self. That is, the romantic poet is inclined to project a vision of the romantic poet into his poetry. That's one of the kind of basic features of romantic poetry. The Rupchak also, like Hrabovich, talks about the basic, I'm quoting again, the basic profile is situated within actuality, as such actuality is constructed within the given frame. The projected profile embodies an act of desire, an imaginative flight out of the actual situation towards the farthest horizons of existence. That is, there is the wannabe and the is. That's not far removed from what Hrabovich does, but Rupchak sees this in two different ways. That is, he is far more focused on the mechanics of the poetry and how this works in the poetry. Typically, he talks about ich gedichte poems. That is, and if any of you remember Bohdan Rupchak, that is, he had to have terminology, right? So ich gedichte, that is, I poems. Right? Focused on the presentation of the poet within the text of the poetry itself. Rupchak, like Hrabowicz, aims to uncover basic meanings. In Rupchak's case, it's not mythological per se, it's actually more cultural and political. But Shevchenko was always about Ukraine, so that part is easy. Leonid Plushch, the third of our authors, is certainly the most complex of these. The book is largely unreadable. I tell you that honestly. I've read this book, and when I try to reread it, I wonder what I understood the first time I read it. Leonid Plushch, as you may or may not remember, was a political prisoner in the Soviet Union. He was a cyberneticist, a mathematician of sorts, but his approach to reality isn't very mathematical. That is, his world consists almost entirely of symbols, and he sees Shevchenko working within this world of symbols, where the duality of Shevchenko is hidden in and provoked by various symbols. I probably owe, in my own interpretation of these two poems, the most to Leonid Plushch, because his book really is about these two poems. And I admit off the top that the talk I'm giving you today is not going to say anything new at all. That is, nothing new at all in the sense of Shevchenko studies and who has said what about Taras Shevchenko in the past. I will tell you nothing that someone else hasn't already said. Hopefully I will make it a little clearer, a little easier to understand than what Leonid Plushch does, because like I said, I don't actually recommend you read the book unless you have to. Okay. But let's start with a simple example of duality. A poem we all know. We know it by heart. Dumimoi. I'm sorry, we're in the wrong poem here. Dumimoi lecho meni zvame, nasho stale na paperi sumnimi riadame. And so on. Бо вас лихо нас від насміх породило, поливали сльози, чом не затопило. We know this by heart, so what's Tarnowski talking about, right? What's complex here? Well, who's he talking to? That is, who is the addressee of this poem? The poet is talking to his poem in his poem, as if the poem he's talking to isn't the poem that's doing the speaking, and as if he wasn't just the author of all this. Right? It's such a simple thing that is, we slip right past this. We don't think about this. But the psychology of this, I don't know if there are any psychologists in the room, but if someone walks into a psychiatric office and starts talking in the language of this poem, yes, sign a contract and lie down on the couch, because we need to talk to you. That is, this isn't the way people behave. There's nothing normal. But there are two voices here. There is some kind of split between personalities. I'm not going to put it up on the screen, but we all know the poem Perebendia. That is where Shevchenko passes himself off in a fictional mode as the Kobzar who runs around. And in that poem, it's very explicit. That is, the Kobzar is two-faced. That is, he plays, rap music numbers for the young girls in the village, and then he goes behind the cemetery and recites weeping songs about the Cossack past. Okay. That's a very explicit, that's an easy version of a split of this duality. But let's look at this. This is the opening of Moskaleva Krinecha. Не варті Богу жить на світі, то йде топиш, а жінка, діти. Отож, то бачиш, не бреши. For these two people. This very clearly is two different voices. There is one guy is saying, oh, damn, it's terrible. And the other guy says, you're a dope. Who are these two people? Well, we need to investigate. This is the beginning of Moskaleva Krinecha. Let me tell you a little bit first about Moskaleva Krinecha. And to tell you about Moskaleva Krinecha, I need to tell you a little bit about Shevchenko's biography. Let's start with 1847. In 1847, Shevchenko has been meeting with his friends in Kyiv in the Cyril Methodian Society, and they get denounced. There's a fellow whose name is Oleksiy Petrov, denounces them. Shevchenko actually gets caught in a nice little trap. The police set a trap for him. It's April 5th. And the Dnipro, like many rivers in the spring, floods. And it's very hard to get across. Shevchenko's on the wrong side. He's on the left side. That is, he's on the eastern side. And he's trying to get back to Kyiv the other way. And the ferry isn't running, right, because of the flood. But there's a pack boat, that is a mail boat, is crossing, an official boat, and that boat is going to cross no matter what. And Shevchenko's begging and saying, let me. And so finally they let him on the boat after pretending that they're not, you're a civilian, you're not going. But they finally let him on the ship. And then midway across the Dnipro, they arrest him. They had planned to arrest him. Shevchenko is carrying with him his poetry. Shevchenko's poetry comes in two kinds, the kind you can publish and the kind you can't publish. And of course, what he has on his person is not the kind you can publish, because that you can go to a store and buy. What he has is what nobody has, except his closest friends, the poetry that you cannot publish. Well, that poetry is a political crime. Shevchenko gets dragged up to Petersburg, and the secret police conduct some kind of investigation. It gets to the Tsar himself. We know the story. Shevchenko gets punished, and his punishment consists of a couple of elements. He is forbidden to write and to paint. And he will be conscripted into the military, and he will be conscripted into the military in the Far East. And so by June 22nd, he's at Orsk Fortress. This is a very big country. I mean, this is Ukraine here, right? Look how small it is relative to the distances we're talking about, right? Shevchenko is in Orsk over here. Petersburg, it's actually off the map. No. So he is, as we say, tam de dichko dobranich kaže, he is off the map in the middle of nowhere. But it's worse than that. That is, what I want you to understand is the psychological state Shevchenko is in after his interrogation in Petersburg, that makes everything very clear what's going to happen with. Taras Shevchenko was born a serf. When I teach students, I say, Taras Shevchenko used to be a cow, and then his freedom was bought, and he became a human being. Right? He was a manumitted slave. Right? And now what's happened? Right? He's no longer free. That is, all of the other people in the Cyrillo-Methodian society were gentry people, They had been born free. And for them, the punishment was that typical foolish Russian punishment. That is, you get exiled and you can't live in the capital anymore. That is, imagine you commit a crime in Toronto and the punishment is you have to live in Oshawa, right? I mean, that's pretty severe, but it's not quite jail, right? And it's not the military either. Shevchenko, and we see this in a number of places, is actually chastising himself. What the hell have you done to yourself? Just for a couple of silly poems, you gave up your life. And this isn't, you know, romantic poets of the George Gordon, Lord Byron variety for whom all this is symbolic. It's not symbolic. You're here in the middle of nowhere, in the army, marching left face, right face. What Shevchenko hates the military. Right? It's not fun. I mean, he's not being beaten over the head every day. He's not in jail, but he has given up his freedom for poetry. He is acutely aware of that. The poetry he writes while he is in jail, of Kazamati, it's not really a jail, in Petersburg, shows this perfectly well. That is, the psychological state he's in. He varies between a certain kind of despair and complete wish fulfillment. Things like Meni Trinachti Minalo were written in jail. That is, Sadok Vishnevi Kolokhate. That is, he imagines all these wonderful things because it ain't like being here in jail. Remember that the next time you think that that's the most wonderful image of Ukraine that you've ever read. It's meant to be precisely that. And so the question that Shevchenko needs to face is, of course, am I going to write? Why should I write? And that's what Moskaleva Krenecha is all about. But let me show you a few other poems he writes more or less at the same time. Wonderful little poem. A numo znovu virshuvach. Zvichajne neshkom. Numo znovu poki novinka na osnovi starinku Bozhu lichvach. A serich. Як би вам сказати, щоб не збрехавши, ну, мо знову людей і долю проклинати. Людей за те, щоб нас знали та нас шанували, долю за те, щоб не спала та нас доглядала, а то бач, що наробила, кинула малого на розпутті та й байдуже, а воно убоге, молоде є сивоусе. You like that? Молоде є сивоусе? You have to stop when you read Shevchenko. Every time you notice something is completely wrong. Молодеє сивоусе, звичайне дитина, і подибало тихенько попід чужим тином. Get the English in sync. Аж за Урал опинилось в пустині, в неволі. Як же тебе не проклинать, лукавая доле? Не проклину ж тебе, доле, а буду ховатись за валами та нищиком буду віршувати, нудить світом сподіватись у гостів недвольну із-за Дніпра широкого тебе, моя доле. Let me turn to the first sentence of the poem. Анумо знову віршувати. He's answering a question. He's answering a question he gave to himself. Am I ever going to do this stupid poetry writing again? It got me in a lot of trouble. Right? Remember, Shevchenko has another career. He doesn't make any money ever writing poetry. You can't make money writing poetry, but he does make money. He makes money as a painter. He's a reasonably good painter. And rich people will pay for portraits of their wives and children all the time. Right? And that's how Shevchenko can make a living. There are other poems like this one from roughly the same time. I'll just read you the first line of one. Nedla ludei tiei slave. Why do I write? Nedla ludei tiei slave. Because the writing I do out here is not going to get me anywhere. I want to read myself organized here in all my papers. I want to read you a letter Shevchenko writes to his friend Lizahoop. It's October 22nd from Orsk. He got here like 2 months ago. That is, he gets to Orsk in the middle of June, as I recall. There's a translation underneath. I'll read. This letter is in Ukrainian. Shevchenko writes letters to various people in Russian or Ukrainian. To Lizahoop, he writes in Ukrainian. На другий день, як од вас поїхав, мене арестували в Києві. На десятий посадили в каземат в Петербурзі. А через 3 місяці я опинився в Орської крепости в солдатській сірій шинелі. Чи не диво, скажете? Отже, воно так. Я тепер точнісінький, як той москаль, що змалював Кузьма Трохимович. Кузьма Трохимович is the painter in Квітка Основіненко's story «Солдатський портрет». If you know the story, it's about a painter who tests to see if his painting is good enough to fool people. Yeah. От вам і Кобзар. Позабирав грошики та й шморгнув за Урал до Киргиза гуляти. Гуляю, бодай нікому не довелось так гуляти. А що маємо робити? Треба хилитися, куди нагинає доля. He calls himself a Moskal. Now I need to come back to that word, Moskal. What does Moskal mean? Right? I skipped that slide in the beginning. Кохайтеся, чорнобриві, та не з москалями, бо москалі чужі люди лихо роблять з вами. Well, what's this poem about? It's the oldest story that a father tells a daughter in the world. You can hang around with all the boyfriends you want to, just make sure they're not soldiers. Because soldiers, what are you nuts? Don't go out with a soldier. Soldiers are here today and gone tomorrow. Кохайтеся чорнобриві, та не з москалями, not with soldiers. But then he goes on, бо москалі чужі люди. Лихо роблять з вами, and then later in the poem, вернуться на свою московщину. Right? All of which is actually ambiguous. Right? But in Ukrainian, in the 19th century, the word москаль means soldier. But why does the word москаль mean soldier? Because conscription in Russia in the 19th century was a 20-year affair. That is, when you got conscripted into the army, that is, you're gone. That is, your mom will kiss you goodbye and never see you again. The idea that someone is going to return from military service, almost unheard of. And those who do return, by then they've become something completely different. They are not recognizably what they were when they left. Because 20 years of military service will do that to you. It will turn you into a Moskal. A Moskal in that other sense, a Muscovite. Someone who is, of course, by now, after 20 years of service in the Russian military, you're Russian speaking. When you left the village, you weren't, but now you are. Right? And you behave like a soldier. Behaving like a soldier can mean various things. It could mean drinking too much and chasing women, or it can mean you behave like a pun, right? That is, that you have too much you think a little too much of yourself, a little too high. And so this moskai word is a word of opprobrium in the Ukrainian vocabulary in the 19th century. And that's important to understand, because when Shevchenko writes to Lizohub and says, Ya moskai, sorry, that means something. That is, I've become something different. I've been transformed into something I wasn't before. Back to where I was. So, let's turn to the poem Moskaleva Krinitsa, The Soldier's Well. I put a summary of the poem on the board. It starts with that little dialogue that I talked about, that is the guy who thinks that life isn't worth living, and the other guy tells him he's a dope, right? And then we tell a story. There was a widow. The widow had two children, and one of the children is named Katerina. Oh, well, we remember that, right? Not every girl in Shevchenko is named Katerina. All the others are Oksana. No, not all the others are Oksana, but almost, right? And then there is, she has a son as well. And then there is this orphan. And now we know the Maxim that I'm talking about is this orphan. And so Shevchenko tells this story of a saintly man, Maxim. Could Maxim be anything but saint? I carry the name proudly. Maxim, who we'll discover in the second poem, is Maxim Ulasovich, is just God's gift to mankind. He's just wonderful. He does everything right. He's an orphan, but he makes good, right? And he builds up his standing in the community and his wealth, marries Katerina, and then the community burns down his house. Nice folks, those Ukrainians. Right? It's just jealousy. That is, Shevchenko doesn't say that Ukrainians burned down the houses of everybody, but the community is jealous of this kid. He's doing well, and the rest of us aren't doing as well. Kids died, Katerina ran off, and then there's the whole problem of what to do now, and Maxim, faced with a broken family, does the saintly deed again. Conscription comes to the village, and the widow's son, he's unnamed in the poem, is conscripted. According to the rules of Russian conscription in the 19th century, someone could go in your place. You just need a warm body, right? And so Maxim volunteers. That is why, because a widow will not survive if her only son leaves her. How's she gonna live, right? So Maxim volunteers to become the conscript to let her son stay with her. He goes into the army and comes back injured. He is badly injured, he is legless. He has lost both his legs in the war. And one little detail, this is typical of the army, he's learned how to read and write. So Maxim comes back from the army without legs, but he can now serve the community as the assistant to the cantor, to the dyak. Nakrylushi spivai. And he is accepting of his fate in a remarkable way, and digs a well. That is, it's hard for us to understand what digging a well means, but a legless man teraz Shevchenko, kind of stretching this to the wildest point, digs a well for the community. It's just an act of goodwill. He's a saintly man digging this well. And the poem ends with Maxim dying a natural death, right? And the community cherishing his memory and naming the well Moskaleva Krynecha, the Moskai, the soldier's well, the guy who dug it. What's important here? A couple things are important. What we see very clearly here is a projection of a man who is willing to sacrifice himself for his community. Right? In calling him a Moskai, Shevchenko gives away the fact that he's talking about himself. Because Shevchenko, we just saw the letter to Lizzo Hoop, Shevchenko is a Moskai. The picture, the self-portrait of Shevchenko that's on the poster and was on the very first slide, where he's wearing that hat that says 3P. Well, it's Cyrillic, so it's not P, it's R, it's Treta Rota, and he's a Moskai, right? It's the picture that shows he drew that picture of himself to indicate that you're in the army now, you're a Moskai. Let's look at some of the who are these two voices? Well, if we look at it from the perspective of George Grabovich, then we talk about the adjusted and the unadjusted self, right? It starts with the unadjusted self, the guy who can't deal with reality. I'm going to give up. And the other guy is perfectly normal. You don't want to live? Goodbye. That's the answer. No skin off my back. So there, you see, don't lie. Just sit down and write this tale. That's a key to this poem. That is the two voices, the adjusted and the unadjusted self. The unadjusted self, Taras sitting in Orsh Kripos saying, God damn it, what did I do? How can I keep living? And some other voice saying, no, you just keep doing it. Sit down and write, literally. Just sit and write. Shait I pishe. And the way Shevchenko has structured the poem is dictation taken by the unadjusted self, that's the poet, from the adjusted self. He is listening to the adjusted self telling him what to say. And the adjusted self tells him to write a poem about a saintly man. Таке у тім селі трудящий, бо всюди сиротили дащо, у наймах виріс сирота. Неначе батькова дитина, то сяк то так придбав сірома грошенят, одежу справив, жупанину, та ні від сілі, ні від тіль, на ту сирічку копійчину купив садочок і хатин. Шевченко didn't buy a house and a orchard. But he is this boy. He is the orphan who made, Shevchenko was an orphan. And somehow he made good. He made more than good. That is, Shevchenko was on the in social circles at the top of the world. Right? That's what he's talking about when he talks about Maxim. That is, Maxim is another projection of Shevchenko. But the answer here, that is, how do you live this way? Просохли очі у вдови, отак то дуже мій живе, то й весело на світі буде, і буде варт на світі жить, як матимеш кого любить. Хоч кажуть отче, що не Боже, себе люби, то й Бог поможе, а доведеться умирать, здихать над грішми, ні, не Боже, любов. The answer is not the adjusted self. That is, the answer is not living in reality. But there's one more important aspect of this poem that I want to focus on here. And that is when the two voices return later in the poem. Громада has given the widow's son to conscription, and Максим volunteers to go in his place. Такі-то темні діла творяться нишком на сім світі, а вас письменних треба бити. Щоб не кричали, ах, Аллах, не варт на світі жити. А чом пак темні не кричать? It's a very deep message. The people who are really suffering don't stand up and say, oh me, oh my, I don't want to live anymore. Right? It's you intellectuals. It's you пішменні that talk that way. The common people don't talk that way. And the answer, хіба ж живуть вони і знають, як ви сказали, благодать? Oh, come on, they're not living. They're just creatures. Що-що, не дочуваю. Вони, кажу вам, прожабають. Або по-вашому мростуть, як та капуста на городі. Отак по-вашому, ну годі. Нехай собі і не живуть, а все скажу таке, як хочеш. А ви їм жить не даєте, бо ви для себе живете, заплющивши письменні очі. Заплющивши письменні очі. That is, if you remember Hайдамаке, where Шевченко makes fun of the literate, of all those Russian critics, it's Белинський in particular he's thinking of, but he talks about the literate people, and how, not for me your advice, all you fancy Russian critics. He's turned it around against himself. He is now that fancy critic who is complaining about this, that, and the other. And the voice of the other self here is telling him, you need to be more like Maxim. You need to show tolerance and love. Okay. Next poem I want to talk about is entitled Varnak, another word that needs an explanation. A Varnak is a branded convict. That is, Russia was a very civilized country in the 19th century. Such things did happen. That is, this only happened to criminals. That is, Shevchenko is not at risk of being a varnak, right? Because he is conscripted into the military as for crimes he may have committed, but he's not a murderer, he's not a thief. That is, those would be different people, right? But Shevchenko is, of course, in a situation where he's encountering these people. And of course, a varnak, a branded convict, is just another kind of convict. And so Shevchenko thinks of himself as a convict too. I'm sorry, these are very dark images. They're not from this period, they're from 1857, not 1847. But they are two images from the Shevchenko series about the prodigal son, right? And they're, you know, punishment of convicts, right? Mm-hmm.
let me quickly summarize what happens in this poem. Excuse me while I put my notes back together here. Vatnak is a poem about a bloody criminal. Shevchenko begins this one very much like he began Moskaleva Kranecha, with a kind of a framing device. That is, I met this Vatnak and he told me his story. Right? That is, we all know that anybody who tells you a story about someone I know, I'll leave it there. The convict who is speaking has already been rescued. That is, he has found mercy and he has found religion. Everything is God's will. But he talks about the crimes he's committed in the past. This convict, the story he tells, is a simple story of a village boy who gets called into the master's home because the master has little children and he's educating those little children and he needs for the little kids to have someone to play with, right? And so he calls in a village boy and the village boy plays with the master's children. And when the master's children start learning how to read and write, well, this village kid is there too and he learns how to read and write. And so this little boy from the village, unnamed, becomes something other than what he should be. That is, he is quite literally living in the master's home and behaving more and more like the master's children. He meets a girl, wants to get married with her, but the master sees this young woman, brings her into the home. The young boys in the house, the friends of our hero, the convict, have their way with her, and then they send her packing, and she's a pokritka. She's gone. Our hero, the convict, gets so incensed at what they've done that when these two young men later come back to their manor house for a wedding, he murders everybody there. All right? He murders the panichi, the two lordlings, and all their guests and everyone. So he is, the just criminal story. He's in Ukrainian lore, it's always associated with Karmeluk. And, Soviet critics always had a very hard time with this poem because they all see that here is the substance of rebellious Shevchenko that we all want to find. Here is Shevchenko advocating rebellion against the aristocracy. That is, this convict is that rebellious arm of the Ukrainian nation that will smite down the Polish lords, right? Except that in this poem, the Vatnak is a Christian who is sorry for what he has done, who regrets what he has done, and has turned his life around and become a decent human being. So the poor Soviet critics always don't. That's because this Vatnak is Taras again. That is, he's writing about himself again. That is, you pulled this kid out of the village. You taught him how to read and write. You let him behave as if he were gentry. And then his anger got the better of him. His anger, what anger? Well, Shevchenko in the Trilita period, the poems for which he got sentenced, are angry poems. He didn't kill anybody, But if words could kill, Shevchenko's Trilita period is the avenging sword of Taras against the aristocracy. And here he is again in Orsk, and here Varlak is already from a slightly later period, and he's actually setting out on his journeys to the Aral Sea, which we'll talk about in a second. But very important in this poem, when this, the voice of that young man, Otoż I wczyty poczęli pismu paniat, na bezgłowia I ja oczuся слізьми, кров'ю письмо те полилось. Нас, дешевших панської собаки, письму учить. Молитись Богу та заралом спотикатись, а більше нічого. That is once again, the crime against him was teaching him how to read and write. Something Shevchenko can say only because he sees that reading and writing have destroyed his life. If only I had stayed in the village, I wouldn't be here as a soldier. I wouldn't be punished for what I am today. Okay. Let's move on. I need to tell you a little more biography. In 1847, Shevchenko is dragged along on a Lewis and Clark expedition in the Russian Empire. That is, the Russian Empire is exploring all kinds of places where white people haven't been before. There are people who lived there, but no one's asking them anything, right? And so, an expedition is launched to explore the Aral Sea. You should look it up. Go out on Google and look up Aral Sea today because it no longer exists. Poor Taras had to sail around this Aral Sea, and in the 21st century, it's almost completely dry because the Soviets turned the rivers backwards and drained all the water out of the Aral Sea. But from Orsk, they travel down here across the Kazakh desert. It's 1,000 kilometers of terrible desert. Right? They actually brought a ship from Petersburg. They built the ship in Petersburg. They took it apart, transported it to the Aral Sea, reconstructed it there, and sailed this expedition. I tell you that story that way in particular because Shevchenko hated being in the water. He hated the ocean, he hated the sea, he hated being on a boat. He obviously got badly seasick and thought this was like the curse of death, right? But Shevchenko on this expedition is almost a free man, except for being in the middle of nowhere, right? But he is treated like one of the officers, like one of the scientists on the expedition. That is, he doesn't do mean labor. He was taken on this expedition because Butakov, the captain of this expedition, the captain of the ship, said, holy cow, you've got a painter who finished the Petersburg Academy of Art right here. I need a Polaroid camera. That is, to do this expedition, I need an artist who's going to draw everything we see. And I got this guy here, and he's just wasting his time. No, he's coming with me. And the commander of the fort said, oh, okay, what do I care? Right? So Shevchenko went for 2 years to the Aral Sea and then came back in late 49. And in 1850, he is still finishing up his duties from this Aral Sea expedition and living like a free man. That is, Shevchenko is not living in the fort. He's not in Orska Kripos. He's living in the home of the topographer of the expedition, whose name was Hern. Right? Now, Hern is a very nice and civilized man. He's married, and he has a very pretty wife. And the very pretty wife that Herrn has is a little bit too receptive and a little bit too welcoming to one of the soldiers in the fort, who's this Ukrainian guy, Mykola Grigorovich Isaev, who is, what's the modern term, hitting on Mrs. Herrn, right? And Shevchenko doesn't like it. Shevchenko thinks that this is terrible. He actually blamed the woman. she was a little too receptive for this Isaev guy. And so Shevchenko staged a confrontation where he and Herrn threw Isaev out of the house with a stern lecture to the wife to do this no more. That, of course, has consequences, because Isaev need only write a letter to the officers, but not the officers in Orsh, because they all know this. He writes a letter to Orenburg and to Petersburg saying, well, you know, the Shevchenko guy, he was forbidden to write, and he was forbidden to paint, and he's writing and painting all the time. Right? Everybody knows he's writing and painting all the time. And you know, he doesn't even wear a uniform. Right? He's never in the fort. Right? So this reaches the authorities, and the authorities implement a search, and Shevchenko's arrested again for failure to do the duties that he's here to do and not obeying the law. And of course, other people are reprimanded too. The commander of the fort is reprimanded. But this is why Shevchenko ends up over here. Because in 1850, after this denunciation, Shevchenko is punished again. And obviously, we're not going to leave him here because the people here like him too much. I mean, they're guilty like he is of, you know, allowing him to do all these things. So we're going to send him somewhere where it's really bad. And the Petropavlovsk fortress, which was in most of the 20th century called Fort Shevchenko, but it no longer is, that is the Petropavlovsk fortress, is really in the middle of nowhere. It's on the eastern coast of the Caspian Sea, and it's not a nice place. And Shevchenko is sent there. For 7 years, from 1850 to 1857, Shevchenko doesn't write any poetry at all. He stops writing poetry. He doesn't stop writing, he stops writing poetry. That is, we know that he kept writing. He wrote his Russian prose during this period. We know he kept painting. We have the paintings, right? That is, the commander of the fort at Petropavlovsk was a man whose name was Uskov. And Uskov, as commander of the fort, is living with his family. His wife and his kids are there. And, you know, Shevchenko painted Uskov and his wife and the kids and a family portrait. And Uskov was very good to Shevchenko. That is, Shevchenko spent a great deal of time in Uskov's house. Uskov has a nice house with a big garden. And Shevchenko hides his paintings in Uskov's garden, because it's the kind of situation where he's going to get denounced again if too many people know about this. So he can go out there to work, leave the things there, come back to the fort and say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Okay? And then, you know, 2 days later, go back to Uskov's. And so Shevchenko has given up writing poetry. He gave up writing poetry until in 1857, he gets a letter from a friend of his, whose name is Yakub Kukharenko, telling him that, actually he got a letter before this from another fellow that he's going to be released, and then the letter from Kukharenko. A journal, he's thanking him, Kukharenko wrote, a journal, a magazine, right, a journal, уже 10-й рік і в очі ні одного не бачив і не знаю, що там і діється в тій новій чи в современній літературі. Сам не написав нічого, бо мені було заказано писати. А тепер уже і Бог, і Освятий знає, чи й напишу що-небудь путнє. а ще не дуже зостарився, та знівечився дружми єдиний. А може дасть Господь милосердний ще відпочину та на старість попробую писати прозу. О віршах уже нічого й не думати.
That's pretty radical stuff for Shevchenko to say. He's writing to a friend. That is, once again, critics have said various things about this and say, oh, he's writing for the censors. He's making pretend he didn't write anything. But he actually sent this letter through private channels and never went through the censors. He could have said anything he wanted to, right? He really is uncertain whether he's ever going to write again, right? But he does, of course. We know he did. And 6 weeks later, he writes another letter to Кухаренко.
Постриг ти мене в брехуни своїм братерським листом і своєю щирою писанкою. Дарунок, a present. Я писав тобі, друже мій єдиний, що все вже не втну нічого віршами. Отже, і збрехав. Збрехав і не схаменувся. Правда, я сам думав, що я вже зледащив за холону в неволі. Я ж бачу, ні. Нікому тільки було огню положить під моє горем недобите старе серце. А ти, друже мій, догадався, взяв та й підкинув того святого огню. Що тут на світі робить, думає собі. Та вставши раненько, помолився Богу, закачав рукава та й заходився коло цієї москалевої криниці. Бог поміг, то сяк, то так кончив.
Москалева криниця is the first thing Шевченко wrote when he learned of his freedom. He took a poem he had written before, and he rewrites it. Right? Now, various theories, that is, Шевченко kept his works in something called the Malakhnishka, the Zahalauna, the one that he could hide. Right? When Isayu denounced him in Orsk, Шевченко gave away that book to Herrn, because he knew he's going to get searched. Right? And so they better not find this, right? And they didn't, right? And so we're not sure exactly when Shevchenko later got it back. He had this book, but whether he had it in 57 or whether he got it later, that's not entirely clear. But he writes Moskaleva, he rewrites Moskaleva Krenecha. He clearly knows the poem he wrote before, because half of the new Moskaleva Krenecha is quoting it, that is, he uses the same words, the same lines, but not the same story. And here, we want to what I call Moskaleva 2. The plot line of Moskaleva 2, once again, this introduction, but instead of a learned man and a simple man arguing about whether life is worthwhile, it's Varnak. And the Varnak, the convict, is telling the poet what to write. Same kind of situation, two voices, but the other voice here is now a criminal, this branded criminal. We get, in shorthand, the story of the Moskal who dug the well. That is, it's told much more succinctly. And in fact, in this version of the poem, there are all kinds of things that if you don't know the first version of the poem, you're going to get lost. Shevchenko doesn't dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And so we don't know everything we should. In this equation, most particularly, to give you a concrete example, when Maxim gets conscripted into the army, we're not told he did it to save the widow's son. That's just left out. And so we have no idea how he ended up in the army. Shevchenko just breezes past that. That is, this is a poem that is a reworked version of the first poem, but is clearly meant to be understood in that context. The problem, of course, in this poem is that
as in the earlier Varnak, the Varnak is in love with someone. But the Varnak in this poem is in love with the woman that Maxim is in love with and marries. And so there is this jealousy that prompts the Varnak. In the first version, it's the community that burns down Maxim's house. In this version, it's the Varnak who persecutes Maxim. And to make a long story short, after a little episode where Shevchenko throws in the Russo-Turkish War of the 1780s and 90s, right, he, the Varnak, calls out Maxim, "Hey, why don't we have a nice chat by that wonderful well you dug?" And the Varnak tosses Maxim into the well and kills him. It's obviously a combination of two poems, right? Shevchenko has, in 1857, decided to blend the two poems he had written 10 years earlier, Varnak and Moskaleva Krenecha, into one, and to make some changes. The changes he makes are a psychological indication of his own guilt. That is, Moskai, the Moskai who digs the well, the Moskai I created 10 years ago as an image of my salvation, as an image of my desire to continue being the poet of the Ukrainian people, is now killed by my other ego, by my alter ego. Maxim is killed by the Varnak. The Varnak, of course, is Taras too. That is, one version of Taras kills the other version of Taras. And of course, the problem here is, what does this refer to? It refers to killing the poet. It refers to the 7 years of not writing. That is, after 7 years of not writing, actually writing Russian prose, painting all kinds of things, but not writing poetry, because Shevchenko gave up on himself. That's why he didn't write poetry. He could have obviously written poetry. If he could write Russian prose and hide it, he could just as well have written Ukrainian poetry. It's a lot easier to hide a couple poems than a long novel in Russian. So what we have in Moskaleva Krenecha 2 is a changed Shevchenko. Once again, these are very dark. These are two self-portraits of Shevchenko, one from 1857, the other one from 1858. If you remember the self-portrait of him in an army cap, boy, does he look different. And not just because he's grown this long beard. That is, Shevchenko has aged, but he's aged not so much physically. Yes, he's 10 years older, but he's still a young man. He'll die a young man, right? He's aged psychologically. He has learned the terrible lesson about himself. He has learned the terrible lesson of what it means to push yourself to do something that is going to cost you, of what it means to feel guilty for having stopped doing that. And that's the Shevchenko we see in Moskaleva Krenecha. Thank you.